On this week's edition of New York Now, we'll bring you the latest developments on the state budget. Next, we'll speak with the former DEC Commissioner, Basil Sagos, about his work, tenure, and legacy at the State Department. And then we'll examine the impact of air pollution and discuss how it's being addressed in New York State. I'm Chantal Destra, and this is New York Now.
Today, the Senate majority will pass legislation.
I will fight like hell for you every single day, like I've always done and always will.
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Chantal Destra. It was a busy week at the state capitol with major budget progress. At the top of the week, Governor Kathy Hochul announced the framework for a conceptual agreement for a $237 billion state budget.
Each of us came to the table with really strongly held beliefs. But in the interest of our state, we pulled it together to deliver in a really collaborative way. And I will say, you don't always see that here.
The governor provided broad strokes of a budget that addressed some of the most watched items, including housing, education, and health care. Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie told reporters the pencils weren't down just yet when the governor made the conceptual agreement announcement. Meanwhile, Republican lawmakers claimed Democrats were engaging in a broken budget process.
We think we have a spending plan that's going to be somewhere south of $240 billion. We think there's a housing proposal there. We think there might be something on crime. We think there may be something on cannabis, but we don't know. We have 211 legislators waiting around to see what's in a budget that's going to be $240 billion. So I ask you, is this a good way to make public policy? Is it a good way to do a budget? Clearly not.
By the end of the week, both chambers voted on three budget bills, and lawmakers also voted on the debt service bill, which allows the state to pay its debt at the end of March. So as of this morning, that leaves nine bills to go. When speaking with reporters, State Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins said that they were wrapping up on the last few budget items and expected lawmakers to pass the remaining bills in the coming days.
We are pretty much at the end of what has been an extremely eventful budget cycle.
We'll bring you an in-depth analysis of the elements of the final enacted budget in a later show. Now turning to another topic. For more than 8 years, Basil Sagos led the State Department of Environmental Conservation, which is the longest tenure of any DEC commissioner. We caught up with Sagos during his last days with the department to unpack his work and legacy. Here's that conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us, Commissioner.
Great to be with you, Chantel. Thanks for coming in.
Now, I wanted to get into your decision to take a step back from the department. I imagine after over 8 years, it was a difficult decision. So what was that decision-making process like?
Yeah, this place is like a second home in a way. I mean, the number of days I've been here since 2015, obviously it's been a long run. I think it was when my staff brought in a plaque last year, noting that I'd been the longest serving commissioner, I started to think, wow, maybe that's time. Maybe it's a sign, time to move on. It is a great job. I mean, every single day in this job is a privilege. It's an honor to serve the people of New York. And you just know when it's time to go. I mean, there's a reason that commissioners are short timers generally. You know, the career staff are the ones that really run this agency for 20, 30, 40, 50 years in some cases, and the commissioners come along and kind of pull some levers. I think I've done as well as I could to pull those levers over the last 8.5 years. And, you know, it's time to turn the reins over to somebody else. But it's been an amazing run.
And you said that you were going to stay on until the state budget was passed. So I was curious, what type of funding were you hoping to get for the department in the final state budget? And what are your conversations like with the governor and legislative leaders about the department?
Listen, we've had nothing but an amazing run of support from this governor. And this legislature as well. I mean, Governor Hochul has really put her stamp on the environment. You know, everyone talks about the big things, and rightly so, like the Bond Act, which is a huge accomplishment. I often look at the big things as the more mundane issues. How much has our budget increased, our annual budget in this agency? How much has our staffing increased? And under this governor, we are way up on both those things. And that's really important because that's these are the people and the dollars that we need to spend who are carrying out the really important work that the public wants us to do, and we just can't do it without resources. So this governor has been transformative on that front. This budget's a strong one as well. I mean, I know that, you know, there's this extraordinary debate about where dollars should be spent and how much should be allocated to various programs. But ultimately, and I look back now, I have an 8.5-year lens on this. When I started, we were really scraping by. I mean, we had low staffing numbers. We had a very small Environmental Protection Fund, $136 million. Now it's $400 million. We had almost zero other capital dollars. Mm-hmm. Now almost $9.7 billion. So you just look at the change in support that we've gotten over the over that time from this governor and this legislature. It really is extraordinary. And, you know, I'll leave it to the next commissioner to come in here and find a place that's very well run, that has resources to carry out our mission and is ready for the huge challenges of the future.
And as you mentioned, you have a long resume of environmental work, but was there anything that surprised you when you took on the position of being at the helm of the department?
Oh my God, every day. I mean, I'm surprised even today. You know, I mean, seriously. And I think that's what I brought to the job is just a big open mind and a quest for learning about the agency and its people. You know, if you told me the day I started that we would have become a plumbing company within 2 months, I never would have believed it. But that's exactly what happened. We hit the village of Hoosick Falls. I've talked about that quite a bit recently, which lost all of its water. And it forced us into a very creative posture of having to, how do you address that? And it really brought us 600 DEC staff into a crisis intervention, going house to house, installing plumbing in people's houses. I mean, that was just a huge paradigm shift in my mind about what this agency can do. And we've done, you know, we were active in COVID. We worked, built and managed the drive-through testing facilities, the vaccine sites. We delivered food to people that were homebound and hungry. I mean, we are so creative here. So it's not just the mission and the sort of, you know, the traditional environmental work that we do here. It's there are people in this agency that do incredible stuff that's way beyond their ability. And I think it's we have a real team approach to things. And it's, that always surprises me, just the kinds of things we can do. And that's got to make people, I think, feel like this is a good government. It's a well-run agency. Call upon them to do lots of really important work. And it helps restore faith in government, you know, as I think we're at a time right now that people have been tested, their beliefs in institutions, for lots of reasons. So it's really important when you're in these positions to run this place with a sense of integrity and prove that government can be a force for good.
And are there any environmental initiatives that you may not have had the opportunity or the time to focus on that you wish you could have, you know, dove into more?
God, that probably kept me coming back, is just knowing that there was the next big thing to work on. I mean, and a lot of the stuff is like, take climate change. I mean, this is a fight now that we're launching that's going to take 30 years, really, to play out. So I know I can't last that long, right, in this job. And even you take water infrastructure, it's the same thing. The disinvestment over 30 years, and now we're really hitting it. We're coming on hard. Just announced another $150 million of investment into water infrastructure. So that will never end also. You know, there's some things that I think I haven't done as much as I'd like involve more of the agency itself, the structure of the agency, the sort of modernization of the agency and its culture, its people. Diversity numbers are still very low in this agency. You know, we have done a lot of foundational work to change that, the pipelines into the agency, the retention issues. And yet we still have this kind of traditional model of an environmental organization, which is, you know, really a throwback. So, you know, and for me, creating the Office of Diversity, Inclusion, and Civil Rights, that was my chance, my last chance to put in place something durable that will outlive me. And I think that's what I am most regretting of, is that I didn't get that done earlier.
And in terms of reducing the state's carbon footprint, I wanted to touch on the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which we know has benchmarks in 2030, 2040, 2050, ongoing benchmarks. So how would you describe the progress? I know that, you know, it's definitely something that a lot of people have a lot of interest in. There are a lot of eyes on it. Everyone's very excited, but also nervous about, you know, if we're going to be able to meet those benchmarks. But from your purview, how would you describe the progress being made?
Well, listen, I think it's a little bit like my thought on the agency's diversity here. We've established the foundation. We set the targets, which is good. That was easy. In fact, it was the legislature that set the targets. And now it's on us, and has been on us for the past 3 years, to build the plan to hit the targets. And we're now in sort of year one-ish of crafting these long-term policies that will then carry that out. It sounds very bureaucratic and slow, partly by design. I mean, it was envisioned by the law, but also this is such a dramatic change that the law envisions, that you have to do it in a way that is stepwise in nature and involves the public and puts stakeholders' concerns at ease. Because ultimately, you know, we see the benefits of the action. We know what it'll do for New York. It'll bring extraordinary number of new jobs. It will generate incredible economic activity. It will reduce air pollution locally. It will literally save lives, you know, upwards of 1,500 people a year over a no-action alternative will survive because of the work that we do. So if you want to hit those numbers, you want to get all those benefits long-term, you've got to create a pathway that doesn't scare everyone off, because change is scary. And this is economy-wide, so it touches every part of New York State. And every part of the economy. So we have to do it in a very deliberative manner. You know, hundreds of public meetings, thousands of public comments, and we still haven't cracked the surface yet. You know, we're going to be at this for years to come, and rightly so. So I think we will, you know, be challenged to hit the targets. You know, this is not an easy slam dunk, but you know, we have this governor behind us. I mean, Governor Hochul said, "Do it." Come up with the plan, implement the plan, and make it nation-leading. So there's lots of work going on in addition to hitting those targets. You have all the work on renewable energy right now underway in the state: offshore wind, onshore wind, solar, you know, heat pump industry coming on board, zero emission vehicles. I mean, all of that is underway. So we're not starting from zero, but the long-term plan is going to be a real challenge, and we will meet it.
And years from now, when historians look back at your tenure leading the department, what legacy are you hoping? No, all the historians, but what legacy are you hoping to have had?
I think that I would be remembered as being somebody who was at the right place at the right time, who had the right mindset to bring this agency to new levels, new heights. You know, that is life in general, right? You sort of are. You can prepare yourself for these kinds of jobs. You can study. You can learn. You can get professional degrees, but success sometimes is a product of circumstance. And I came in during sort of a modern rebirth of the environmental movement. You know, climate change, water. Those two really big things. Kind of people begin to come around to that. It happened to be during my tenure. So I think I competently managed this agency. But also I was able to lead within the state, lead issues, lead initiatives, and lead people during this time. And I think it's, you know, it's a big team effort. So again, I'm going to be humble on these things. I work with a few thousand people here who really are the heroes.
Awesome. Well, we wish you the absolute best. Thank Unfortunately, you. That's all the time we have for today.
Great to spend time with you. Thank you.
And we were speaking with Commissioner Basil Sagos of the State Department of Environmental Conservation. Now that the longtime DEC commissioner has left the department, it is up to the governor to nominate a new leader who will then be confirmed by the state Senate. In the meantime, Sean Mahar, who worked as deputy commissioner under Sagos, will be leading the department as interim commissioner. We will bring you updates on who will be tapped as the permanent leader of the department in the months ahead. Apart from going through leadership changes, the DEC has been leading the Community Air Monitoring Initiative, a study looking at air pollution in disadvantaged locations across the state. As reported by the EPA, inhaling black carbon has been associated with health issues, including cancer and birth defects. Producer Dana Wright spoke with the D.C. and environmental experts for a deep dive on the impact of air pollution. Here's that story.
I was going for a jog with Josh Merlis of the Albany Running Exchange. We were in Watervliet, right next to I-787. 787 runs through a densely populated area of the capital region, and due to its proximity to the Hudson River, it also runs by a lot of places where people like to get fresh air and exercise. But with all of this traffic, is the air really that fresh?
What is it that you think we're breathing in right now from all the cars?
Well, whatever's coming out of their exhaust pipes, which is not something I really want to be breathing.
After our run, during which no cameramen were injured, I kept thinking about air quality. I myself live close to the highway, and I wonder what that means for me and my neighbors.
So I know that those cars were emitting something that's, you know, not good for our health or for the environment, but I'm not sure what. So I'm going to have to figure that out.
So with these thoughts in mind, I decided to head over to UAlbany's eTech building, where I met up with Dr. Sarah Lance, a researcher at the Atmospheric Science Research Center. We had a quick talk about breakfast.
Are you a ketchup with eggs person or a hot sauce?
No. Okay.
And then got down to business.
If I'm standing next to a highway, what are some of the things that I'm likely breathing in that situation?
Next to a highway, you're gonna get definitely particulate matter. Aerosols is another word for it. These are particles that are suspended in air. Each one is too small to see with your eye, but they're always around us. Actually, in this room right now, we probably have 1,000 particles in each centimeter cubed of volume of air. Coming out of your tailpipe, you're going to have a lot more. There's also gases like carbon monoxide, which are very harmful to human health.
So these little aerosol particles, what are they made of?
So the particles, especially the ones coming out of your tailpipe, mostly it's going to be carbonaceous aerosols, so organic material, and also black carbon, which is like soot.
The EPA says that breathing in black carbon is associated with cardiovascular and respiratory issues. And apparently these particles are so tiny that they can easily enter different parts of our bodies.
Freshly combusted particles are very small. That's a really good point. So it's not just the chemical composition that might matter, but it's also the size. So they can go actually into your cells. They can pass in, you know, into your body and get transferred to other parts of your body as well. And so then your body has to work to try to eliminate that. It causes inflammation, which is your body's response to the pollution. Aerosol particles are a little bit complicated as far as their effect on climate, but black carbon specifically is black. It's kind of like asphalt. It absorbs light, right? And it becomes warmer. They're tiny little particles, but if they're distributed over a large enough area, they can still have quite a big warming effect. If you have ice or snow, which is usually white, so it's very reflective. It's the exact opposite of black, right? If you get that aerosol particle depositing onto that, it'll make it darker. And so that'll melt faster and it'll have a warming effect on the air around it as well.
There are environmental concerns about black carbon that ends up in Arctic climates. And in New York, there's concern about the health of folks who are regularly exposed to diesel trucks, one of the major sources of black carbon.
Once I had a better understanding of aerosol pollution, I decided to focus my attention on what actions New York could be taking to address it. And that's when I learned about the Community Air Monitoring Initiative, a DEC study looking at air pollution in 10 different locations across the state. I'm about to head over to the DEC building to discuss this initiative with Margaret LaFarre, who is the Assistant Director of the Division of Air Resources.
So the Community Air Monitoring Initiative was one of the requirements of the Climate Act. It directed us to look at air quality in 4 disadvantaged communities. The governor increased that to 10, and we contracted with a company called Acclima. Acclima has sensors installed in the back of Toyota Priuses. They drive around communities and gather data continuously. The purpose of this data collection was to identify sources of pollution and then recommend strategies to reduce emissions or at least reduce exposure. One of the main findings is that air pollution is highest near roadways. Not surprising. The best way to reduce emissions from roadways is electrification of the fleets. But we know that's going to take a long time. There could be ways to prioritize where some of the spending goes for electric charging infrastructure, electric vehicles, electric buses at schools. But on the exposure side, we could maybe recommend air filtration systems, especially at sensitive receptors.
I also met with the Deputy Commissioner for Equity and Justice, Adriana Espinosa, to talk about how the DEC is working with the 10 communities from the initiative.
Moving forward now from study to mitigation phase in this program, how we'll work with the communities is to empower them to develop community priorities based on what the data has shown. For example, if we say, hey, there, it seems like pollution in this area is a little bit high, you know, what if we change the truck routes so that we can move some diesel trucks off of this area? And a community-driven solution might be to let us know, hey, actually this proposed truck route goes through an area where we have daycares and schools. We would prefer not to have this. How about instead we consider vegetative solutions and we try to put in some bushes and trees and different things that can create physical barriers and green barriers between the pollution and the community. It's not just New York State and DEC setting the menu. The menu is driven by, again, people on the ground.
What makes air quality an environmental justice issue?
So air quality has been a concern for low-income communities and communities of color really for generations, and it's in large part due to a legacy of historic discrimination and past harm in zoning and land use and siting decisions that tend to concentrate facilities more associated with air pollution in lower-income communities and communities of color. I think it's important for the public and for New Yorkers in generally to know this is not just a study. Sometimes we feel a sense of sort of study fatigue or engagement fatigue from community members. But I think it's important to know that we're required by law to take that what we learned and to develop statewide mitigation strategies.
When looking at emissions in general, remember that a lot of pollution is intertwined. So things that are sources of greenhouse gases can often be sources of co-pollutants. This means that addressing those sources can provide a host of both health and environmental benefits. But even with environmental legislation and programs taking place, there's still a lot of work to be done, and that can be frustrating. But when it comes to air quality, Margaret has a reason for us to be hopeful.
Many people don't realize the improvements that we have made in our air. Growing up in the 70s, just the smell and the colors of the smoke coming out of a smokestack were so much more prominent than they are now. New York City was horrible. You couldn't see more than a block away. And while we still have work to do, we have made some huge improvements to the air quality.
We are capable of making positive change for our communities. We've done it before, and we can do it again. And that's exactly what we're looking into with this series. What other work is happening in New York to improve our environment? You'll have to wait until next time to find out. Until then, I'll see you outside.
For more New York and climate episodes, you can visit our website. That's at nynow.org. And as we attempt to be a more environmentally aware society, it is important to take a step back and shed light on some of the most historic environmental issues so that they are not repeated. One of them is known as the Love Canal tragedy. In the late 1970s, it was reported that the 15-acre neighborhood in Niagara Falls had been built atop dozens of gallons of toxic chemicals. Residents of the neighborhood band together to bring awareness to the issue and prompt action on the state and federal levels. One of those neighbors was Luella Kenny. At the time, it was suspected that her son, Joe Kenny's death, was linked to the toxic chemical environment.
So it's about time you people woke up and stopped fooling around here and do something decent. And care about the people that live in this city. I won't stay in this city. I don't want to. And I was born and raised here, and I always stood up for this city. 42 years I've been in this city, and now I don't give a darn about it.
And it wasn't just the Kenny family. After the outcry from neighbors, hundreds of families were relocated out of the area, and then President Jimmy Carter even declared a state of emergency.
Then we learned that that sewer had a direct connection to Love Canal. And then we learned that dioxin had been found in the sediments of Black Creek. And in fact, the levels found there were higher than the levels found at any other place in the Love Canal area.
Dioxin, or the 2,3,7,8 tetrachloride dioxin, is there. It's in the sediments, presumably as a reservoir. It's probably in the water. It's being bioconcentrated in living species. These are tremendously high concentrations of such a toxic chemical.
What about the fact that this person, this family's house is right on the banks of that stream?
It's frightening that they would be so close to such a reservoir of toxic chemical.
Love Canal became an important story that continues to be examined and referenced today. You can watch the A Love Canal Family documentary and find information on the upcoming American Experience film, Poison Ground, The Tragedy at the Love Canal, on our website. Again, that's at nynow.org. Well, that does it for this edition of New York Now. Thank you for tuning in and see you next week.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET.